Chapter 7. The Inquest Starts. The coroner's inquest started Wednesday morning, following a long interview between Frank and Newt Lee, held Tuesday night at the police station. Detectives stated that the two suspects were brought face to face in the hope that Frank could wring a confession of guilt from the Negro. Scores of witnesses, including girls from the factory and many others, arrived at the police station Wednesday morning to testify at the inquest. The inquest began at 9:10 a.m. between closed doors in the room of the Board of Commissioners. Call Officer W.F. Anderson and Officer Brown testified as the first witnesses. They went into full details as to how they were notified of the murder and how they found the body on that gruesome Saturday night. Officer Anderson's testimony contained a vivid and revolting description of how the body was mutilated and torn. In the dim light of the cellar, testified Officer Anderson, the body could not be identified as that of a white girl's unless the observers were within at least 15 feet of where it lay. He was present, said the witness, when somebody picked up a note near the body. He identified it as the one written on a slip of yellow paper. Later, somebody found another note. He didn't identify that. About 5 feet from the girl's body, a pencil was found. Near it was a pad from which the slip evidently had been torn. He described the basement, a long, narrow enclosure between rock walls, with the elevator shaft near the front, a boiler on the right about halfway back, a partition on the left shutting in an enclosure which seemed to be a waste space, an open toilet on the right beyond the boiler, the girl's body on the left, beyond that, and a door at the back end. The girl's left slipper was found near the elevator. She wore no hat that he could find. He didn't remember distinctly how she was dressed, but believed it was in some dark material. Officer Brown followed Anderson on the stand and gave testimony extremely damaging to Newt Lee, declaring, as did Anderson, that it was impossible to tell the body was that of a white girl unless within a very few feet of it. He said that only until he rolled down the stocking below the knee and saw the flesh could he tell the girl was white. He described the fearfully dirty appearance of the body, stating that only by being dragged could it have accumulated so much dirt and grime. He also told how they had tried to reach Frank over the phone in the early morning hours, but had not been able to do so until several hours later. During Brown's testimony, a dramatic incident occurred. The little girl's clothes, a one-piece purple dress with white trimmings, one shoe, a black gunmetal slipper, were shown to the jury. As they were placed in a heap on a chair, Mary Fagan's brother rose from a seat in the corner, stared in horror at the pathetic little pile, and ran from the room with his hands clasped to his head. At 11:45 a.m., Newt Lee himself took the stand. He testified to coming to the factory at 4 o'clock, leaving when told to do so by Frank, coming back at 6. He told of Frank's nervousness, of Gant's visit to the factory, of Frank calling him over the phone to ask him if everything was all right early in the evening, and of finding the body. Newt testified that he found the body face up, although detectives and officers say that it was face down. Newt swore, however, that he did not touch the body. In answering the allegations of the officers that he could not tell it was a white girl, he declared he could tell by the hair, which was always different in white women from black women. The last witness to testify before the jury adjourned Wednesday morning was J.Q. Speer of Cartersville, who swore that he saw a girl and a man Saturday afternoon in front of the pencil factory, that they were excited and nervous, and that the girl was the same one he saw Sunday at P.J. Bloomfield's chapel, the dead Mary Fagan. Wednesday afternoon, the first witness to testify was George Epps, the young newsboy who came to town on the car with Mary Fagan. An interesting phase of his testimony was the statement that Mary had told him that Mr. Frank had winked at her and looked suspicious. E. L. Santel testified in regard to seeing Mullinax with a girl whom he supposed to be Mary Fagan late Saturday night. Another witness, a neighbor, said he had seen her about 5 o'clock near her home, while a third witness, who had told detectives that he had seen Mary Fagan that afternoon, appeared at the inquest to say that he was mistaken. Santel was convinced by officers that he was not sure the girl he saw was Mary Fagan. R.P. Barrett, a factory employee, testified to finding the blood spots near Mary's machine on the second floor, showing that she may have begun her fight for life there instead of in the dark basement. Gant took the stand and told the same story that he had already told to detectives. J.W. Coleman, stepfather of Mary Fagan, testified to the anxiety of himself and her mother on the night of the murder. Frank M. Barry, assistant cashier at the Fourth National Bank, was one of the important witnesses at the hearing, and he declared that, in his opinion, the notes found by the girl's body were written in the same hand as several other notes which had been written at police headquarters for the detectives by the Negro watchman, Newt Lee. The inquest then adjourned until Thursday. When the inquest adjourned at 6 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, the detectives had made one step toward solving the mystery of little Mary Fagan's death. This was the arrival at the conclusion that the little girl had never left the factory after she went there shortly after noon Saturday to get her pay. Assertions that Mary had been seen at midnight with Mullinax, and that girls corresponding to her description had been seen at various hours Saturday afternoon in the neighborhood of the factory, one by one were probed deeply and found to be unfounded. E. L. Santel admitted that it was Pearl Robinson and not Mary Fagan that he had seen with Mullinax. Other witnesses, who were supposed to have seen the little girl Saturday afternoon, came forward to declare that they might have been mistaken. This underbrush cleared away, officers could find a working basis at last, a substantial supposition that Mary Fagan never came out of the pencil factory alive. As a result of their conclusions, Gant and Mullinax were released from custody at the temporary adjournment of the inquest Thursday afternoon, an inquest which was in session for but a few minutes. Coroner Donahue had called 160 witnesses, most of them factory employees, and after swearing them in at 4:30 p.m., announced that the investigation of the little girl's death would be postponed until the Monday following. Hardly had this news been announced when a bigger sensation followed. Newt Lee and Leo Frank were ordered transferred to the Fulton County Tower until the conclusion of the inquest. At police headquarters, it was given out that the two suspects were taken to the tower because there was considerable doubt as to the legality of detaining them on city warrants, as both had been arrested in connection with a state and not a city case. The coroner's warrants by which the two men were taken to the tower were exactly alike in each case, save for the names. Frank's read, Georgia, Fulton County. To the jailer of said county, greetings. You are hereby required to take into custody the person of Leo M. Frank, suspected of the murder of Mary Fagan, and to retain the said Leo M. Frank in your custody, pending a further investigation of the death of said Mary Fagan, to be held by the said coroner of said county. Herein Fail not. Given under my hand and official signature this, the first day of May, 1913. Signed, Paul Donahue, Coroner. With the two men in the tower Thursday, and two other ex-suspects released, there appeared to be but little doubt that in the persons of Frank and Newt Lee, the detectives had the key to the mystery. Yet there was another man in the toils of the law, a man whose arrest created such little excitement at the time that a bare paragraph was devoted to it in the newspapers. Yet later, this man was to startle the public with the most sensational statement that was ever told until the trial started. He was James Jim Conley, Negro sweeper at the pencil factory. Conley was arrested at 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon, on suspicion, and was confined at police headquarters, together with Snowball, elevator boy at the factory. The latter never figured prominently in the case. The slight interest which Conley's arrest caused at the time is shown in the newspaper account of it. The sixth arrest in the Fagan murder case was made by detectives at 1 o'clock Thursday. James Conley, a Negro sweeper employed at the National Pencil Factory, was seen washing a shirt at a faucet in the rear of the building. Before he had completed the work, detectives, who had been phoned, walked in and placed the man under arrest. There were certain marks on the man's shirt. He claims that they are rust marks. The detectives will hold him at least until a chemical analysis can determine for certain whether or not the stains were caused by blood. The Negro declared to the police that the shirt was the only one which he possessed, and that he washed it so he could appear in it at the inquest to which he had been summoned. His statement is believed by the police. At this time, theories and tips still poured into the detective office. Many of Frank's friends were working personally on the case in their endeavor to clear the cloud of suspicion which hovered over the well-known young superintendent. He was prominent in the community, liked by a wide circle of friends. He was president of the local Hebrew organization, B'nai B'rith, a leader in church and social work, of good standing in the business world, a college graduate, pleasant to talk with no small amount of personal magnetism and charm. Even at that early hour, when very trivial circumstances were held up against Frank, his friends rallied warmly to his support. Theories of how Mary Fagan met her death, and by just what system her murderer can be brought to justice, were flooding the office of the detectives. People called over the phone to tell the officers just how they should proceed. Many of them came in person, and the office was in receipt of hundreds of letters from this and half a dozen other states, giving advice and theories. Many of the letter writers were anonymous, but most of the people signed their names. Several letters had been received from criminologists who were willing to divulge their theories only for money. Several letters came from seers and mystics who communed with the spirits and learned in that way the identity of the murderer. Among the interesting callers at police headquarters were two ladies who dreamed about the murder. Both said that they distinctly saw Mary Fagan in her desperate battle with the murderer. The ladies arrived within a short time of each other, but their dreams didn't coincide. Both gave the chief accurate descriptions of the murderers of their dreams. While friends of Frank were flocking to defend him, there was an equal amount of condemnation voiced against both him and the Negro. Mutterings and threats began to fill the air, and when the detectives showed that they really thought either Frank or Lee the criminal, according to the public's view of it, by taking the two to the tower, sentiment reached fever heat. That Thursday night promised ugly things. Fear of what might happen in the then aroused state of affairs caused officials of city, county, and even the state to take extremely precautionary measures. Thursday night, Governor Joseph M. Brown advised Adjutant General J. Van Holt Nash to communicate with officers of the 5th Regiment, National Guard of Georgia, with a view to having the troops in readiness should an emergency arise. The governor also warned the jail authorities and the police to be on the lookout for any signs of trouble on the part of the populace. In response to the warnings of the governor, Colonel E. E. Pomeroy, commanding the 5th Regiment, gathered his men at the Auditorium Armory, a few blocks from the tower where Frank and Lee were behind bars, and held the troops there until a late hour of the night. At 11:30 p.m., the soldiers were allowed to return to their homes, rumors of mob violence having proven groundless. From Thursday until the coroner's jury convened again Monday morning, there was little of real interest to crop up in the famous case, although rumors and speculations continued to grip the city and the state. The cupidity of the public for news continued at a high pitch, and Saturday night the militia was again ordered to be in readiness in case trouble should come up. Solicitor H. M. Dorsey held a long conference Saturday morning with Chief of Detectives Lanford and Coroner Paul Donahue, a conference which, it was understood, resulted in the summoning of more witnesses for the inquest and a unifying of the forces of city and state at work on this case. All day Saturday, the city was alive with rumors that there had been a confession from one of the two prisoners in the tower, rumors which the officials indignantly denied, and which later turned out to be entirely unfounded. So did the first week since Mary Fagan's body was found end, with the best forces of county, city, and state, and outside agencies at work on the case, with two suspects in the tower, and the whole state looking forward to what the coroner's inquest might develop when it convened again Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock.